Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The General Assembly is at work during their so-called long session in which they work on the budget, and right now two budget bills are working their way through that body, one from the House, the other from the Senate. Meanwhile, Governor Josh Stein has yet to veto a single bill in this session, despite the legislature lacking a supermajority by one vote and therefore their ability to automatically override his veto. On Friday, he signed six bills but did not act on more controversial bills sitting on his desk, including one allowing people to carry concealed weapons without a permit, and two immigration bills. Those and other bills have a clock ticking on them. Unless he vetoes them or signs them, they will become law without his signature when that clock runs out. Today, a closer look at the current session and where certain bills stand. Brian Anderson is a freelance journalist covering state politics on his Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter. Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for WUNC. And Mary Helen Moore is a reporter for NC Newsroom, a journalism collaboration focused on state government for public radio audiences and stations, including WUNC and WFAE. Good morning. Welcome to all three of you. Welcome back to those of you who have been here before. Welcome.
Great to be here, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Colin, some of the bills introduced in the legislature and some of the moves they've made to lessen the governor's power would seem to be putting these two branches, the legislative and the executive, on a collision course. At least it appears that way from the outside. So far, so good. We have key legislators talking nicely about Governor Stein, and Governor Stein treading pretty carefully around certain legislators. Is that accurate, or are things going on behind the scenes that would indicate more friction, Colin?
That's where things stand, particularly in public. I mean, you mentioned the bills that were signed last week. You had this signing ceremony in which several of the key Republican lawmakers were standing with him for photo ops as he was signing the bills. He avoided doing anything on that day, any of the more controversial bills dealing with guns or immigration. But I think, you know, this honeymoon period may be coming to an abrupt end at some point, possibly in the next couple of days, as he has to act on some of these bills that feel almost certain to be vetoed, including one that, as you mentioned, sort of shifts the powers from the executive branch, from state agencies being able to pass their own regulations, to having the legislature sign off on these. That's a bill that I think passed both chambers in the last couple of days, headed to the governor's desk, in addition to some of these more sort of culture war oriented bills that are headed to Stein. So there's going to be some tension there between these two branches, even as they probably try to work together on some other things where there's potentially common ground between Republicans, particularly in the state House, and Governor Josh Stein.
Brian, we continue to have this bifurcated government with the Democratic governor. We had Governor Cooper for two terms. We've had now Josh Stein reelected as a Democratic governor, and yet the legislature continues to hold the continues to contain a majority of Republicans. Is that because North Carolinians want to split that power? They want to have one party in charge of one branch and the other in charge of the other branch? Is it because of gerrymandering? Is it because this time around of the Republican candidate for governor? How do you explain this bifurcation?
Well, the answer to all those is yes. But to break it apart, you know, in a redistricting has played a very big role in whether Republicans have a supermajority or not. This year's maps were actually more politically favorable than 2022. And even despite that, for Republicans, they lost a seat. So they lost their House supermajority despite having a better map drawn their way. So that kind of shares some direction of the state having some resistance to the GOP. At the same time, the Council of State, this 10-member executive body, that is pretty evenly split. So statewide, it's kind of a mixed bag. But what I would say for the relationship between the governor and the legislature is it's divided. We're just going to see it sooner than we have in the past 5 months, because this has been a historically unproductive session at the legislature. They've got like 12 bills into law, and we're 5.5 months into session. At this point in previous cycles, it would be like 30 plus bills into law at this stage. So there really hasn't been a lot of divisive bills to even make their way to Stein up until this point.
And Mary Helen, Brian just mentioned, they lost their supermajority by one Republican missing in the House. In the Senate, they do have a three-fifths majority in that body, Republicans do. But because they don't have a supermajority, they can't automatically override a gubernatorial veto. They'll need to recruit a Democrat or two to make that happen. But so far, Governor Stein has not vetoed anything. What's that an indication of?
You know, it'll be interesting to see if he does. I mean, he's been very kind of mysterious about saying how he will proceed, especially on these immigration bills. The House Speaker, Dustin Hall, has said all session that he has an effective supermajority. He believes he can win over a Democrat when needed or take advantage of absences as needed to override those vetoes. But yeah, I'm we're eyeing this deadline of Friday to see if that will be tested this year.
Yeah. The budget is this is the session where they deal with the budget, the long session every 2 years, and the budget lasts for 2 years ostensibly. It happens every odd number year. And just as in Congress, we have each house having their own budget bill. We have the governor having his budget bill, and the two House and Senate budget bills are winding their way through the legislature. We were told yesterday that they will not be able to reach an agreement on reconciliation by the end of the month, which is the end of the fiscal year. What are the primary differences, Brian, between the House and the Senate versions of the budget?
So there's a lot of differences. I'd say the biggest ones are the Senate is more aggressive in how it wants to reduce personal income taxes than previous budgets. And this comes at a time when nonpartisan budget analysts are warning that the tax cuts that have already been implemented and are going to be implemented are going to put the state in a budget deficit. So the House is saying, you know, maybe we need to hit the pause on 1 year of tax cuts and scale things back a little bit. And the Senate does not like that. That is a big sticking point. The other one I would say is when it comes to state and worker and teacher pay raises. So for starting teacher pay raises, over the next 2 years, the House wants a 22% pay increase for new teachers. For those who are just entering the profession, they want a 22% increase to your base pay. And the Senate, they're at a whopping 1.2% or something around there. So, I mean, pretty night and day type of figure. So those are just a couple of the ones. The other big one that folks should know about is probably for the funding source for hurricane relief. There's some differences on an NC Innovation Fund and a children's hospital and where money should come out of to help people in Western North Carolina recover. Everybody agrees that there needs to be more relief for Western North Carolina. But exactly how that gets done remains a major sticking point.
How do you explain the philosophical differences between Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate? Because this really is a battle among Republicans. The Democrats are there, but they're not going to make the final decision. Between taxes and pay increases for state employees and teachers, how do you explain the fundamental difference?
I mean, fundamentally and historically, the Senate's more aggressive in tax cuts than the House wants. And the House may have some more pork than the Senate wants for policy priorities. And that's just kind of a difference when you have when you have 30 members in your caucus in the Senate, Republicans, and then you have 71 Republicans in the House, you're going to have a lot more members in the House making a lot more specialty one-off requests than the Senate might. But the Senate really wants that money historically and in its latest budget proposal just to kind of go back to taxpayers for contributing. And I think that's really the issue that is continuing to persist.
Yeah, Senate Leader Phil Berger is definitely calling the shots a lot in the Senate because he has, as Brian mentions, fewer people to sort of wrangle in his caucus. And he just tends to be much more fiscally conservative than House leaders, whether that's the former Speaker Tim Moore or the current Speaker Dustin Hall. That seems to be the big difference in why you see such a big split between the Senate Republicans and the House Republicans, almost to which they're two different political parties in some sense.
So both of these bills, both of these budget bills, Colin, propose spending about $65.9 billion over the next 2 years. Governor Stein submitted his own budget, of course, which governors do. It proposes spending over $68 billion. Is his budget even a factor in this? Are there certain things about his budget that Republicans can stomach and pass into their versions of this bill, or has it been dead on arrival?
I mean, governor's budgets tend to be dead on arrival, regardless of which party is in charge. It's just sort of a formality of here's my recommendations. And usually they'll take a few minor things that are priorities for the governor and get that in there. I think this year Stein has a little bit more leverage because the numbers for Republicans on a veto override are so slim in the state house. So I think there's some motivation to try to get to a point where maybe he could sign the budget bill. I think the odds that they come out with something close enough to the House budget bill, which he's signaled some level of support for, at least aspects of it, that's unlikely to sort of be the final budget deal to where he's not vetoing it. But certainly that's where he has any sort of say in the process, is just sort of using the prospect of a veto as leverage to get at least a few of the things he wants. But really, in terms of the broad, bigger picture spending document, the legislature is going to be calling the shots.
So in May, economists from the Office of State Budget and Management and the Fiscal Research Division updated their consensus revenue forecast. My eyes are going to cross. It projects that the state will collect $180 million less in revenue for this fiscal year, primarily due to lower than expected corporate income tax collections and lower profits because of the on-again, off-again tariffs that we've been talking about at the national level. But we're talking about a $65.9 billion budget versus a shortfall of $180 million. It seems like a drop in the bucket. Is this a blip on the radar in these budget discussions, or is it a major factor, Brian?
Well, there have been reports from nonpartisan budget analysts within the Office of State Budget Management, and then you also have the Fiscal Research Division. They collaborate. So these are nonpartisan people coming up with these projections. And there have been internal reports sent to lawmakers saying that in the coming years, there can be a $2 billion annual shortfall in revenue. And so this is on top of that, those previous estimates. So it's not just you're $100 million in the hole. What's the matter when it's $70 billion we're talking? It's adding to the hole that's already projected. Now, Republicans would say we've seen these doom and gloom predictions before. They seldom, if ever, come to fruition. Those are based on the assumption that we don't have any policy changes, like casino gambling, that adds revenue. So online betting, sports betting, that adds revenue. There are things you can do to bring money into the state and tax things like medical marijuana if you did something like that. So there's always talk about how you can add more revenue. But the biggest thing I want to impart on people is there's not going to be a budget resolution at the end of this month. And the biggest thing that means is if you're in the federal government, you know, we have stalemates and collapses, and then we can't enter our national parks and federal employees are laid off. Here, when we don't have a budget resolution, the recurring funds, so the state government operations, that does not go away. What is put on the back burner are planned teacher raises and things that are non-recurring spending. So I would think of this budget breakdown as a serious thing, but not nearly as bad as if there was like a federal breakdown.
I have less than 30 seconds. Well, I have less than a minute left. These doom and gloom predictions that they point to that Republicans in the legislature say never come to pass, are they right? Is that true?
I'd say yes and no. I mean, we have not seen a moment where we've seen a lot of inflationary pressures, tariff pressures. So we're certainly in a new moment than in the past. So I'd say it remains to be seen. But Republicans certainly have a point that predictions in the past have not come to fruition.
Okay, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about, aside from the tariffs and their impact on business and potential business revenues and tax collections that result from those revenues, why they see less revenue coming in. And then we'll get to some of the particulars in these tax proposals or these budget proposals when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's going on in the legislature and bills that the governor has signed, has not signed, waiting to sign, may veto, etc. Brian Anderson here is here. He's a freelance journalist with Anderson Alert's Substack, which has become a kind of go-to thing if you want to know what's going on up there. Colin Campbell also is with us. He is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC in Durham and Chapel Hill. And Mary Helen Moore is a reporter for NC Newsroom, which serves public radio stations throughout the Carolinas, including WFAE. We were talking about the fact that some of the one department of the government, the Office of State Budget and Management, is predicting lower revenues in the coming years, partly due because of lower tax collections, because of the on-again, off-again tariffs and people not being, corporations not being able to predict what their revenue may be like. Are there other factors playing into these predictions of lower tax revenues coming in? I'm not sure to ask that. Go ahead, Colin.
So that's where these projected or scheduled future income tax cuts come into the picture. Part of the reason that the governor and his fiscal team and others are predicting a fiscal cliff a couple years out is that the way we have these revenue triggers set up, every time the state's overall revenue picture grows, the total amount of money that the state government is taking in, you get to a certain level in that, and the tax rate on personal income taxes and corporate income taxes is going to drop. And so what we've seen in these projections is, even if the economy did really well, even if you didn't have some of these external factors that are driving uncertainty in the overall economy, you'd still see an even sharper drop in those tax rates over the next few years. And that results in what I've been told is sort of unprecedented, at least in recent history, where you look several years out and the overall amount of revenue the state's taking in is dropping, even as our population is increasing, even as inflation goes up. And that's what's got economists worried. But it is several years out before we get to that point, which I think is why you see perhaps less urgency among at least some lawmakers in trying to deal with that in this budget cycle.
So when we hear the word drop, we should translate that into lower taxes for people paying those taxes. The current tax rate for personal returns is scheduled to drop to, I think, 3.99% next year. That number is set to be automatically reduced, as you point out, if the state's general fund revenue exceeds a certain trigger amount for that year. And the House version of these budget bills would keep those triggers in place through 2027. The Senate wants to remove the triggers and reduce the personal tax rate to 2.99% by 2028, with a goal of eventually reducing it to 1.99%. That's a big difference. How likely, Colin, are they to reach a consensus on this?
I think that's really the key point in why we don't have a budget now. We're not going to have a budget before the fiscal year ends in a few days. And we may not see a budget at all this year, in part because the current law has these tax cuts scheduled in. So that sort of advantages the Senate's position of supporting these tax cuts, because if they do nothing, if they don't pass a budget at all, these things stay in effect. And what the House wants to do is slow them down a little bit. And that's going to take legislative action and agreement between the House and Senate, which we don't seem to be at yet. So this is essentially the factor that's preventing things like teacher raises, state employee raises, other spending the state wants to do from getting passed, because there's so much tension between the two Republicans in the two chambers over how to handle these tax cuts and what sort of revenue picture the state needs several years out.
And there's
go ahead.
There's one thing they agree on, and that's corporate income tax rates between the House and Senate. They disagree on the individual side, but on the corporate personal tax cut side, this is another example of Stein's budget being a kind of fruitless endeavor. Governor Stein had said, let's hit the pause button on individual and corporate income taxes. And then what lawmakers said is, maybe we need to consider that on the personal income taxes, but for the corporate income taxes, those are scheduled to phase out by the end of the decade, going down from 2.25% to 0% by 2030. So that's another revenue shortfall that's going to happen. And both sides, neither the House nor Senate budget touches that corporate income tax rate.
Are they factoring in the impact of artificial intelligence, which we are told will be arriving, the impact of which will be felt within the next 2 to 5 years? And what we're talking about here is artificial intelligence not only taking over lower level, entry level blue collar jobs, but now white collar jobs, even white collar management jobs. If no one's working, there's no tax revenue to collect.
Okay. I don't think there's been any discussion about AI's overall effect on North Carolina's economy. There's so much uncertainties around that for one, but this is a legislature that tends to be more reactive than proactive. So I think that's the sort of thing that will come up when they start to see job losses, if they start to see job
Well, that's
losses
my
in the
next
state of
question. If
Missoula.
they proceed on the more optimistic point of view that the Senate seems to have about we can lower these tax rates and all will be well, if it turns out not to be the case, if they're not collecting enough money, et cetera, can't they come back into session and change the tax rate?
Yeah, I mean, they could do a budget trailer bill week or a budget technical corrections bill at any point they want. So assuming they pass a budget, they have the ability to come back and make tweaks as they see fit. That usually happens in the fall where they'll realize, oh, we made some language errors, or we need to go back to the drawing board, or we implemented something and maybe it becomes an issue. So if there's some AI takeover issue, I mean, they are able to come back to the drawing board and address it then. And I think Colin hit the nail on the head that if we took a poll of how many of the 170 state lawmakers know what AI even stands for, I'm not sure you'd be pleased with the results of that survey.
It's definitely an older room when you look around the crowd at a legislative session.
So since Brian, you brought up these pay raises, let's talk about that for just a second. Both versions of the budget have different pay raise rates for state employees and for teachers. And when it comes to teacher pay, the House is proposing to increase starting teacher pay to $50,000 with an 8.7% raise over 2 years. The Senate proposes average teacher pay of $62,417, which is an average 3.3% increase over 2 years, with a $3,000 bonus at the end of that period. Now, those are not apples to apples comparisons. So explain this to me. How far apart are these two proposals?
I mean, ask a teacher, would you rather have $510 or $9,000? I mean, that's the difference in annual salary we're talking about over the next 2 years between the Senate and the House proposal. So they're very much far apart. And if there's no budget resolution, then the pay raise is 0% for the time being. You don't have pay raises if you don't pass a budget, other than what's already been happened in previous budgets. So, I mean, they're definitely on very different ranges. The one thing that, interestingly enough, House Republicans have said is that their budget is even more ambitious than Stein's for teacher pay raises, because the first year in that 2 year budget plan, the House's number is greater than what Stein's budget plan was for year one. So Stein is over the moon thrilled with that portion of the House budget. And I've talked to some folks who are like, maybe Stein's support and private encouragement for House members to support the budget, maybe that actually hurts House Republicans in negotiations with the Senate. But there's certainly big differences.
Colin, just I think it was just last week. It's hard, the news cycle moves so quickly now, it's hard to remember when things happen. But the fiscal year ends at the end of the month, that we do know. And House Speaker Republican Destin Hall said, I think last week, he was hopeful and frankly optimistic that the final budget would be done in June. Ralph Heiss, who's a Mitchell County Republican and the Senate's lead budget negotiator, wasn't hopeful about that. And yesterday, House and Senate leaders announced that they probably would not reach an agreement by June the 30th. Is this optimism expressed by Destin Hall, was it because he's relatively new in that position, or is it because optimism helps to drive the eventual outcome?
I think optimism is helpful. This is a movie we've seen multiple times before at the legislative building, and part of why all of us as journalists who are a little bit more realistic or pessimistic, depending on how you look at it, tend to not believe these predictions when we hear them at the beginning of session that they're going to get it done on time. Certainly, them setting that into the fiscal year June 30th deadline helps them get some momentum early on, but we've certainly seen budgets. I mean, 2 years ago, it took them till late September to pass a budget. Last year, they were supposed to do budget adjustments, which typically happens in even numbered years. They couldn't get agreement on that at all. So I think this is sort of par for the course in recent cycles where, you know, the goal is certainly to get a budget by the end of the fiscal year. But them completely blowing past that deadline is become more the norm than an exception.
Yeah,
So we'll
the
go go ahead.
The tone has just gotten increasingly dejected over the past few weeks. Like a month ago, it was, yeah, we'll definitely be able to get a budget by July 1st. And then last week, I think it was, I'm optimistic that we will continue talking. And then yesterday, it's like, yeah, it's not happening.
I don't think they're even talking very much at this point, it's from what it sounds like.
Yeah, I asked Berger where the state of things was, and he had a pretty candid quote. He said, quote, I just don't think we should continue to give folks the impression that we're working towards getting a budget done. So those are his words. It doesn't get more clear than that.
So we'll wait and see when, if ever, that will happen. But in the meantime, let's talk about some of the things that have happened, Mary Helen. We have a new Speaker of the House and a new governor who seem, on the surface, to get along. But last week appeared to be the first test of the balance of power between the branches, at least when it comes to legislation. Josh Stein signed three bills into law on Friday. All three were described as non-controversial. What did they concern?
Yeah, one of those was delivers on a campaign promise by the state treasurer, who is a Republican. So he wanted to change the model for investing the state's, I think, $127 billion pension fund into him being solely responsible, change it to an investment board. So a five-member body with appointees that get to vote on where to put this money. That was non-controversial. Stein was very supportive, and he signed that one. Another one was around law enforcement officers, kind of encouraging older law enforcement officers to keep working. There's kind of a structure. There was a structure in place previously that encourage retirement at 62 to capitalize on the maximum benefits after retirement. And then the last one would allow social workers to collaborate and provide services across state lines. This has long been kind of an issue for social workers. You know, most families, a lot of families are spread across state lines, like our boundaries. Like I have family in Virginia, South Carolina, Tennessee. It's very common. So if something were to happen and kids would need to move across states, that can sometimes be very difficult. And it became really acute, I think, after Hurricane Helene, when people couldn't stay in North Carolina, had to go to relatives in Tennessee or what have you. So all of those bills got signed, and so did three others, just without an audience. But yeah.
And there have been several other bills that have been signed into law, passed and signed into law. They include HB 47, the Disaster Recovery Act of 2025, Part 1.
Yeah.
That's what it's called. HB 74, which is the House Budget Technical Corrections Bill. I guess they're fixing something. Senate Bill 477, the Department of Natural and Cultural Resources Agency Bill. Senate Bill 248, Birth Certificates for Persons Adopted. These are sexy titles. And House Bill 477, a rewrite of retirement death benefits. Did all of these bills have bipartisan support? How important or how nebulous are these bills?
Yeah, as far as I know, they all had bipartisan support. And the really divisive bills, the culture war bills, so to speak, we still don't know what is going to happen with those on immigration, guns, those sort of things. So,
yeah, let's talk about those, because there are these two other bills that were on Governor Stein's desk on Friday that he has yet to sign. And there are two more, I think, that have been languishing there a bit longer. So let's start with Senate Bill 153. That is the so-called North Carolina Border Protection Act. It is essentially an immigration bill. What would it do?
It does a lot. This is the far more wide-reaching of the two immigration bills. It requires state agencies to cooperate with ICE, requires UNC system schools to not block ICE if, say, they were interested in finding out or deporting an international student on one of those campuses. It bans providing benefits to people who are in the country illegally. And then it also, probably most controversially, allows lawsuits against so-called sanctuary jurisdictions, Mecklenburg County, is considered one of those by a lot of people, by victims of crimes if they're committed by illegal immigrants.
So, in other words, victims of crimes committed by illegal immigrants could sue those cities for allowing them shelter or sanctuary. Why is Mecklenburg County considered a sanctuary area?
Republicans believe your sheriff is not collaborating with ICE, that he's blocking the immigration officials' ability to pick up people who are held in their jails. Now, he says he's not doing that. He's following the law, but he cannot keep people in ways that violate their constitutional rights. So there's some disagreement there, but yeah.
Yeah, we've had many conversations with Sheriff Gary McFadden on that very topic, and he says he cannot break the law. He's sworn to uphold the law, and the law says after 48 hours you have to let people go or charge them with something. There is this other immigration bill, House Bill 318, the Criminal Illegal Alien Enforcement Act, that expands on previously passed legislation, and that also seems to be a bugaboo for a lot of sheriffs, particularly ours here in Mecklenburg. What's the difference between this bill and the Senate bill we just talked about?
Well, one of the things it does is it deals with that 48-hour hold. So right now, the Mecklenburg County Sheriff and certain others are operating under the rule that 48 hours begins as soon as you take someone into custody. So this bill would say, no, that 48 hours begins when you would release that person from custody. The bill also adds certain cases to the list in which those holds are required to be honored, like drunk driving, for example. So, how that plays out in reality is if someone gets picked up for drunk driving on a Friday night, and they would originally be released, bailed out on a Monday morning when they go before a judge. Instead, that 48-hour hold, if they're in the country legally, would begin Monday morning, giving immigration agents a couple days to come pick that person up. And yeah, that's going to result in a lot more detentions,
And
people believe.
Gary McFadden, along with other Democratic sheriffs in the state, allege that even when they notify ICE that they're going to release these people because their 48 hours is up, ICE does not come and pick them up. Has there been any discussion about that? And I have 20 seconds in the legislature.
I have heard that argument too, and yeah, I mean, the Trump administration has really been pushing for more deportations, hiring more ICE agents. So we'll see if more
Okay.
deportations do happen.
More to talk about with regard to these immigration bills when we come back, along with several other bills moving their way through the House and Senate, including our transportation bill when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's going on in the legislature and bills that have and have not been signed, etc., with Brian Anderson, freelance journalist and author of the Anderson Substack newsletter. Colin Campbell's with us, Capitol Bureau Chief from WUNC, and Mary Helen Moore, reporter for NC Newsroom, which is a public radio collaborative where they share reporters, where we share reporters, because she's sitting in the studios at WUNC. UNC in Durham, but she works for us too. She should come down here more often, Mary Ellen. We were talking just before the break about the House Bill 318, which is the Criminal Illegal Alien Enforcement Act that passed with one Democratic vote in the House. Carla Cunningham from Mecklenburg County voted yes. What was her reasoning?
She has long said that she wants her sheriff to cooperate with ICE. And so she supported a bill last session, House Bill 10, that required more collaboration with ICE by local sheriffs. And she has not wavered in that belief.
So we have this disagreement between the sheriff here and in other locales, particularly among Democratic sheriffs, that they are following the law and they are being asked to break the law to comply with ICE. Is there any third-party referee out there saying who's right on this? Because we keep having the same discussion over and over and over. Brian, I'm just curious. Do you know?
I'm not going to say who's right and who's wrong. I will say what happens is generally the legislature passes something with the intent of these Democratic sheriffs doing something that they want. These sheriffs then find a reason not to do what is stated in the bill, stating a different interpretation that they had. Republicans then try and fix that, and then another concern. And so the vicious cycle of tension continues. I mean, I can't say who's right and who's wrong, but I will say.
Question was, is there a third party determining that? Have the courts gotten involved in this at all?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly talk of this ultimately being resolved in courts if you continue to have these disputes. For now, there's a hope from Republicans that this clarifying language will prevent it from going to the courtroom and sheriffs will implement that order. But, you know, North Carolina in the courtrooms are certainly favorable to Republicans right now.
Yeah. So more than a dozen Latino elected officials from across the state have sent a letter to Governor Stein urging him to veto the two immigration enforcement bills because they believe that they would criminalize immigrants and divide local communities. Is the governor, Brian, on the same page?
I'd love to tell you, but unfortunately, at a Friday 8 a.m. News conference, he wouldn't take any questions from any reporters. And I think WUNC and WFAE had a note about that in their reporting when Stein invited reporters, you know, reporters wanted to ask about the other bills that were on his desk, and he didn't take questions. Anytime I've reached out to their office, it's been, we're reviewing the legislation.
The one thing they say is that Governor Stein believes that immigrants who are here illegally and have committed crimes should be deported, but that's pretty vague statement in light of how specific these two pieces of legislation are.
So and let's realistically, move. he's gonna veto these bills. Maybe he doesn't veto the one that Cunningham supported because you feel like maybe you'll get overridden. That would be the only reason to not veto that one. So, I mean, we're certainly going to see vetoes, and he has until, I believe, 11:59 p.m. on Friday to act on those immigration bills, and there's a gun bill he has until next Monday to act on.
We're going to talk about the gun bill right now, as a matter of fact. But that's when that deadline passes, these bills can become law without his signature. A week ago, the House voted 59-48 to allow people to carry concealed guns without a permit. Currently, the law requires people to get a permit from their local sheriff's office and pass a background check. Republicans have said those requirements infringe on people's Second Amendment rights, while at least one Democrat says that this law will result in people who don't know the law and who won't know how to behave or act around law enforcement carrying a gun. It should be mentioned that two Republicans voted against this bill. It remains on Josh Stein's desk. So, Colin, do we know what he's thinking?
I think the likelihood, given the party line vote on this, not a single Democrat voted for it. You don't have the situation we talked about a minute ago about the immigration bill where one Democrat, Carla Cunningham, was voting in favor with the Republicans. So I think that largely signals that we're going to see a veto on this bill. Certainly, this is one of the biggest change to gun regulations in North Carolina that we've seen in quite some time, taking away this concealed carry permit where you have to go take a class, you have to pass a background check, you have to apply for a permit, you have to be over 21 in order to carry a concealed handgun in this state. This would change it to where if you're over 18 and you're legally allowed to own a gun, you're fine. You don't need any of that. You don't need any sort of permit from your sheriff's offices. So this is something that folks who are pushing for, you know, Second Amendment expansion, reduction of gun control sort of things have been pushing for a while and haven't been able to get Republicans on board. This year they have, but as you mentioned, it's not all Republicans. They've got the two House Republicans who voted against this, some others who just didn't show up the day of the vote. So I think this could probably be the hardest lift for House Republicans to get this across the finish line if the governor were to veto, which appears that he's likely to do.
There's one more bill waiting for the governor's decision to sign or veto, HB 126, Mary Helen, which would amend the laws governing voluntary agricultural districts. Now, this passed both chambers without a single no vote. Since I live in Mecklenburg and Urban County, tell me what this does and why the governor waited to sign it.
That one has flown over past my radar, so I'm not sure what that one
Anybody?
Does either.
I'm looking at the bill description for you, and because it passed unanimously, we focus on conflict as reporters. But it, according to the bill, it does amend the process for state and local agencies and governmental units to condemn or rezone qualifying farmland in a voluntary agricultural district. So,
yeah, there's a lot of these small bills that have passed unanimously and sort of make some minor tweaks to law. I mean, if I were to like trying to figure out sort of the overall theme of this session, a lot of it is doing really minor things that everyone agrees is probably fine, because that we haven't seen any sweeping policies, but we've seen a lot of bills like that that, as we've mentioned, sort of fly below the radar. Nobody's against it. Probably only affects a small number of people.
So here's a bill.
Bring them in and say we support it, and we have our lawmakers with us. Look at our unity.
Here's a bill that is probably flying under the radar everywhere in the state except Mecklenburg County, and that is our transit bill, where we're asking the legislature for permission to put on the ballot in November a referendum for a 1% sales tax for transportation. It would fund billions of dollars of projects in Mecklenburg County. What the General Assembly is considering is allowing that referendum. They're not saying do it, you can tax. They're saying you can ask the voters if the voters will allow for the tax. It was said to be a long shot and a very difficult lift in the legislature. But recently, Mecklenburg Republican Tricia Cotham, the bill's primary sponsor, was able to push it through not one, but two committees. Well, she's the primary sponsor. She pushed it to the Transportation Committee. Then it went to another committee, the Finance Committee. And I'm told today it's in yet another committee. The bill has morphed several times, but the version presently in front of the people is the one that we kind of sent to them after being told to change it. It provides for 40% of the money going to rail, 40% for roads, and 20% for other forms of public transit. This has people in Matthews, a bedroom community of Charlotte, upset because it will not allow for the Silver Line train to go to Matthews. And House Majority Leader Brendan Jones from Columbus, who supports this bill, said about a week ago that they were working on a compromise that might please Matthews. Mary Helen, do we know where that stands? Do we know what that compromise might be?
I don't know what that compromise might be, but on the House side, at least, that bill has gotten the hardest parts out of the way. It's in rules today, which means it will likely be scheduled for a vote in the full House later this week. And then we'll see what the Senate does. We'll see if it takes it up before they plan to leave at the end of next week. So
this is, I guess the clock is ticking on this, because not only do we have to get permission from the legislature, we have to get it in time to put it on the ballot. We have to get it in time for advocates to promote the vote, because this is going to be an off-year election and a lot of people don't vote. We have the lowest voter turnout already in the state in Mecklenburg County, and a lot of people don't vote in these off-year elections. The bill has local political and local business support, and we're just asking for permission to ask the voters if it has their support. Is this too much, Brian, for the legislature to deal with the great state of Mecklenburg on? Is it just too much for them to consider?
You know, when you have lengthy, nuanced policy debates, it's hard to work that into the final 2 weeks. From everyone I've talked to, the focus right now is on hurricane relief, and this is not the major thing that's taken up the oxygen. So I'm not sure we're going to get a resolution by the end of next week.
Colin,
yeah, it's one of those things where it doesn't really have a whole lot of opposition. Republicans in other parts of the state are happy for the folks in Mecklenburg County to tax themselves because it doesn't affect their bottom line as much. But I think, as Brian mentioned, it's a question of priorities. They don't have a lot of time. They've got a lot of bills that have a lot of momentum.
Explain this to me. Hold on here. I know it's a basically fundamentally rural legislature, and they probably don't understand a lot of urban problems. But this congestion here is a major problem, and whether or not this solves it is another question. But that really is a question in this case that's up to our voters in Mecklenburg County. So what's the big deal? Why is this such a heavy lift if it doesn't involve revenues from the state to be put into this? Why do they care? Just say yes and move on. What does it take time?
I think it gets a lot mixed up in people's thoughts about transit in general and whether light rail is the right answer. As you mentioned, this is a formula between how much are they improving roads versus how much they're spending on a new transit project. And I think that's where Republicans get a little concerned, or they're not happy with the details of it, because plenty of Republicans don't live in Mecklenburg County. They wouldn't necessarily have to pay this tax that much, but a lot of them drive through that to get to the Charlotte airport or wherever else they might be going. So a lot of people have opinions about how Charlotte grows and handles its infrastructure, even if they don't live there and actually make the decision that the voters would make under this particular bill.
The murder this past weekend of the Speaker of the Minnesota House, Melissa Hortman, and her husband Mark, along with the wounding of another Minnesota legislator and his wife, and with plans by the alleged attacker in those cases to go after others, have had an impact on lawmakers here. Brian, the General Assembly Police Chief Martin Brock says that his department is working on security plans for legislators. What might those plans entail?
I asked him and others, and they're unwilling to publicly say, specifically out of concern for just if you publicly share the specific details, that can present some safety concerns for lawmakers. But I've been told that, generally speaking, there's going to be added security protocols in the legislative complex, and so in and out of the building. I'm gonna wager you might see more of a physical presence of officers as an added precaution, or you might see them in more heavily foot trafficked places.
But 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 as
But
we but as we have seen, these crimes that were committed over the weekend did not take place within the Minnesota legislative building. They took place in these people's homes, and this is a legislature that wants to pass a bill that allows concealed carry with no permitting, no background check. Aren't they at cross purposes here in terms of protecting themselves?
the advice that's being given, certainly to lawmakers right now, is in light of this, the officer there, the chief, had said, you know, if you guys want a briefing on security protocols or how best to reach out to local law enforcement, General Assembly Police, the issue, I think, in the Minnesota case in part was someone impersonating an officer. And I think what you're trying to do now is educate lawmakers on if you get that knock on your door, if you have any distress potentially, here's how you should handle it. And so that is the next steps. But certainly there's an argument to be made that, you know, as North Carolina is potentially going to make concealed carry permits a thing of the past, it's notable that the General Assembly, you're still certainly not able to bring a firearm to the building.
Meanwhile, Democratic Representative Julie Von Hafen of Wake County reposted, this is not her post, she reposted a video this weekend on Facebook featuring an image of a protester holding up a sign at a No Kings rally. The sign said, "In these difficult times, some cuts may be necessary," and it pictured a guillotine flanked by two life-size heads, one of which, it could be said, resembled Donald Trump. Again, this is not her holding the sign. She did not make the post. She merely reposted a photo of this. But some have called for her resignation. What has she said about this?
She had a 33-second long apology on the chamber floor, reading from a phone, and the hope was that would address the concerns Republicans had brought to her attention with it. And the apology came 3 days later after her post. And essentially, since her social media posts, she made her Instagram account private. She deleted her Twitter account. She's limited and heavily restricted how people can comment on her Facebook page posts. And I asked the House Speaker about, you know, does that present any concerns for public access to lawmaker records or anything like that? And he took it in a different direction. He said, you know, I think the less people see from her social media, it's probably a good thing. But for now, there may be a censure if House Republicans have an appetite for that, but it seems at least to be chilling right now.
And something very similar nearly killed the career of Kathy Griffin. The federal government has made a move to defund PBS and NPR. Now the state has proposed, the state Senate has proposed slashing $4 million of the roughly $10 million PBS receives from the state, while the House includes a $61 million cut to the UNC system. I only have 30 seconds, Colin. You work for WUNC. What has your management said about this?
So we don't receive state funding, so this mostly affects PBS North Carolina, the statewide network of PBS stations, and they would be looking at potentially a 30% cut to their overall budget, so really drastic things that affect them, while most of us in public radio are worried about federal funding that affects WFAE and WUNC at a much smaller level, but still a pretty big hit to our budget should the U.S. Senate take up those cuts.
And with that, we must stop. Colin Campbell is the Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC. Mary Helen Moore is a reporter for NC Newsroom. And Brian Anderson is Anderson Alerts Substack. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.